It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. Here are some scenes from a presidency during a holiday week. On Monday, the president met with his war cabinet to plan strategy for Afghanistan. On Tuesday, Mr. Obama and his wife hosted the Prime Minister of India at a state dinner. On Wednesday, the president pardoned a turkey. And while all this went on, the White House is still pushing for a health care overhaul. Much of the debate centers on what the bill will cost the government, but polls show Americans worry more about what they have to pay. NPR's Julie Rovner has our report.
The extent to which people will be able to afford the coverage they're likely going to be required to purchase has been largely overlooked in the current debate. That's a big mistake, says MIT economist Jonathan Gruber.
I think if let's put it this way, it is 10 times as important as the public option has received 1/100th of the coverage.
That's because in the end, whether or not health care is affordable may have a bigger impact on the bill's political popularity than whether the final price tag exceeds $1 trillion. Joan Alker heads the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families. Her group commissioned a survey of what voters want most in a health overhaul bill.
We found by a 2-to-1 margin that the priority of voters was to make health coverage more affordable for families rather than making sure health reform doesn't cost the country too much money.
Defining what's affordable is tricky, says economist Gruber. One thing economists look at is disposable income.
Do people have enough income left after they spend money on other things we think they have to have? That is, we think no one should have to go without food or shelter to get their health insurance.
Another test is whether people would buy something voluntarily.
And if they would, then clearly it's affordable.
But Gruber points out that there's a third test, and it's that affordability is in the eye of the beholder. And for a lot of beholders in the real world, health insurance costs are quickly becoming unaffordable. Take Eric and Cynthia Cathcart. They're self-employed musicians from Silver Spring, Maryland. They have 2 kids and 2 cats. They've been buying their own coverage for 14 years. But with costs going up every year and the complications of some pre-existing conditions, they now pay $1,000 a month for 2 separate plans. Cynthia Cathcart says she's not sure how much longer the family will be able to continue.
I've got 2 deductibles. If Eric and I are in a common accident, he's got to meet his deductible and I got to meet mine. We're looking at an $8,000 deductible.
So how would the bills help families like the Cathcarts? In both the bill that passed the House and the one now before the Senate, people would be required to buy insurance if they don't already have it. But they'd get government help to pay for plans if they earn up to 4 times the poverty level. That's about $88,000 for a family of 4. Plus, no family would have to spend more than 10% of their income on health insurance premiums. Poor families wouldn't have to spend more than 2% on premiums. But premiums are only the start of what people spend on health insurance. There's also deductibles, co-payments, and other out-of-pocket costs. And Gruber says that when it comes to that sort of spending, the House bill is far more generous than the Senate bill. For example, for someone making 2 times the poverty level, or about $22,000 a year, in the House bill,
that means, you know, something like a $500 deductible plan. On the other hand, in that same range in the Senate, now we're talking like a $2,500 deductible plan.
And that, says Gruber, might stretch the bounds of what people consider affordable.
I'm a big believer that people need to pay more for their health care. You know, I'm a big believer in this consumer skin in the game. But $2,500 deductible is a lot to ask of someone making $22,000 a year.
And it brings Gruber to the ultimate test of affordability, which he says,
it's a political test, which is, do people revolt if you say I'm going to mandate you to pay this much?
That revolt hasn't materialized in Massachusetts, the only state that currently requires everyone to have health insurance, and where Gruber serves on the board that oversees that plan. But Gruber concedes that Massachusetts was a lot less divided about imposing the requirement in 2006 than the rest of the country is today. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
There is no recession at the Dry Dock Brewing Company. This beer maker in Aurora, Colorado, is the next place we visit in our series on small businesses. Reporter Kirk Siegler from member station KUNC has the story of a brewer that's expanding thanks to loyal customers, a tasty product, and a bit of help from the federal stimulus bill.
For Kevin DeLang, the fermenter is where it all comes together, his extra special bitter ale, and lately, his profits.
And then it will spend the next 2 weeks in the fermenter. And that's when the yeast really works its magic. It eats that sugar and turns it into alcohol and carbon dioxide.
And then beer, which DeLang can make a lot more of now that he's bought a sixth fermenter at his modest brewery. Dry Dock is tucked away in a strip mall in the Denver suburb of Aurora. DeLang beams as he stands next to the shiny silver 15-foot-high tank.
The primary bottleneck is the number of tanks that you have to actually ferment the beer. So you can only make as much beer as you have room to put it to ferment at one time.
DeLang expanded his successful brewery into this new, bigger space this past summer. The federal stimulus bill helped him get a waiver on the closing costs of his Small Business Administration loan. All he had to do was promise to reinvest the money in his business, and the $20,000 he saved just happened to be the cost of a new fermenter.
That single fermenter probably created a half a job.
But DeLang says it's creating ripple effects across his business. He hired that halftime brewer because there's more beer to be made.
And then more customers come in. We need more bartenders. We've gotten so busy that now I need a full-time bar manager to handle that.
And possibly a new bookkeeper so that DeLang can concentrate on strategy and marketing. All this is quite a milestone for a business that has just 7 full-time staffers. One of those is head brewer Bill I. He was hired on this summer. I was lucky to score the gig. Earlier this year, he was laid off from a larger chain brewery nearby.
It's not like I'm an IT guy and there's so many firms out there. There's a limited number of breweries in the city, and when I was looking for a job, I talked to everybody. And when I say everybody, we're talking 15 places, 10 places. I mean, there's just not that many breweries.
But I still figures the so-called craft brewing industry is fairly recession-proof. And if Dry Dock is any indication, beer drinkers are staying loyal even in tough times. Take regular Tobin Anderson. He's sipping an India Pale Ale in the brewery's spacious new bar during a busy happy hour. At 6.4% alcohol by volume, he says an IPA goes a lot further than a domestic, like Coors or Bud.
I mean, you get more bang for your buck.
And Anderson says he doesn't mind paying the premium, $4 a pint.
You know, it's excellent beer. You know, you pay a little more, but it's worth it to me, plain and simple.
Down the wood-paneled bar, owner Kevin DeLang is pouring a sample of Bismarck Alt, which won a gold medal at the Great American Beer Festival this fall.
The Alt beer's a German style. It's amber in color, really clear, has a little bit of hop bitterness at the finish.
Dry Dock also won Small Brewery of the Year at that festival. DeLang thinks that was due to the brewery's impressive 4-year run. Sales have grown by at least 30% each year.
Cheers.
Cheers. DeLang is already looking at expanding again, possibly into a warehouse space, so we can start bottling and shipping beer around Colorado. For NPR News, I'm Kirk Sigler in Denver.
NPR's business news starts with another frustration for General Motors. GM had a plan to sell its faltering Saab unit, and now that plan has collapsed. Unless another buyer emerges soon, the Swedish car brand could be history, NPR's Frank Langfitt reports.
Koenigsegg, a small Swedish sports car maker, had planned to buy Saab. The company suggested delays by GM led it to drop the bid. That change of mind seemed to catch GM off guard. Quote, "We're obviously very disappointed," said GM CEO Fritz Henderson in a statement.
This didn't come as a surprise. It always seemed like an unlikely match.
That's Michelle Krebs. She's a senior analyst with Edmunds.com, the car consumer website. She says Koenigsegg is a niche player, and it didn't seem to have the management heft or financing to take over Saab.
What's the likelihood that there is anybody else out there in the wings who's a viable candidate to buy this company?
I think the odds are very low, I think I'd look to China if there is a potential buyer.
Indeed, Beijing Automotive was working with Koenigsegg on the Saab deal, but it's not clear whether the Chinese company is still interested. GM said it will assess Saab's future in the coming days. In its heyday, Saab was a quirky-looking brand that sold individualism. But through October of this year, Saab had sold just 7,400 cars in the U.S., If Saab shuts down, it will become the third GM division scrapped in 2009. GM has already decided to kill Pontiac and Saturn. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.
While the job market has been bleak for months, military veterans are having an especially hard time. In New York State, the unemployment rate for combat-age vets tops 15%. NPR's Jim Zaroli attended a job fair for vets in New York City that drew more than 2,500 people.
It was perhaps fitting that the job fair was held aboard the Intrepid, the decommissioned aircraft carrier that's now a museum. Many of those who showed up had been out of the service for years. 44-year-old Kenneth Gary fought in the first Gulf War.
I was on tanks. I was an M1 tanker. So you pretty much can't do nothing with tanks out here.
After leaving the Army, he got an associate's degree and went to work at Costco until he was laid off early this year. Now he's on food stamps for the first time and looking for anything he can find.
From January until October, I was living on my 401k. Now it's run out. Now I need a permanent job right now.
So what's the job market like right now?
It's tough. It's really, really, really tough. Like, as you can see, it's a lot of people out here looking for jobs.
In fact, a long line of job hunters snaked down the Hudson River as far as the eye could see. Once inside, they could talk to several dozen recruiters, a lot from public sector employers like Amtrak, but also some from FedEx and Sears. Wayne Packer was there from Lowe's.
We're actually building about 5 stores here in the Metro New York City market, and we're looking for leaders within our stores and probably about 700 total hourly employees to work in this location.
Among those who approached his table was Gil Eichen, a Vietnam vet who's just been laid off after many years at the same company. He showed Packer his resume.
I was a loyal employee to this company. You okay. Take a look how long I've been there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my heavens.
People
look at that. Me. My goodness, 40 years. That's fantastic.
Before he was laid off, Eichen worked at a company that prints newspapers, not exactly a growth industry these days. The job hunt is just as tough for less experienced vets. 29-year-old Roberto Alor has spent almost 2 years looking for work after leaving the Army. Now he sleeps on his parents' sofa. He says he'll work anywhere, even McDonald's.
I'm trying to look for a job, but every time I'm looking for a job, they need people with experience plus people with education, which I couldn't because every time I was in the Army, I had to drop my classes because country's first.
It's a common complaint. New York Commissioner of Labor Patricia Smith says many returning vets have been called back to active duty in Iraq and Afghanistan several times, and so they've had trouble completing their education.
What we're seeing is that veterans' lives are disrupted, I think, in ways that we hadn't seen in the past. I mean, it's a tough unemployment climate for anyone. But for someone like that, I think it becomes even more difficult.
And without a degree, says Joseph McDonough, you're basically nowhere. McDonough got out of the Marines a few months ago and still has the haircut to prove it. He used to run a warehouse at Camp Lejeune. But like a lot of vets here, he believes most employers don't really value military service.
The only people who actually see it as being anything glorious are people who are like senior citizens who know that somebody sacrificed something. Now it's, oh, they went away, they didn't go to college. I went to college, I know more than them. They kind of like sneer at you.
But like any good Marine, McDonough is nothing if not self-reliant. He's looking for a temporary job to pay the bills, but then he plans to go to college to study accounting. Jim Zeroli, NPR News, New York.